KALW.
From Berkeley to Soweto to Palestine, the people will be free. Power to the people!
Calls for universities to divest from Israel echo a time 40 years ago when students made similar demands to boycott South Africa for apartheid.
The regents of the University of California agreed today to sell all their stock in firms doing business in South Africa. It's the largest divestment by any American institution so far.
Today, we explore the similarities and differences between the two movements. Then, why Gen Z is underperforming at the polls?
So my friend was like, you should come with me and register to vote. All you need to do is register. It'll take 5 minutes.
We hear from the teens in a story from TBH. That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Over the last 2 months, universities around the country have been dealing with protests against the war in Gaza, and the Bay Area is no exception. One of the central demands is university divestment from Israel, or having the endowment stop investing in any company that does business in or with the country. In just the past few weeks, presidents at universities across California have said they'd begin looking into divestment. Almost exactly four decades ago, UC Berkeley was at the heart of a different divestment movement against apartheid in South Africa. KLW's Eli Cohen looks to the past to understand the present.
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free! Free Palestine!
Free! Free! Free Palestine!
The first time I visited the encampment at UC Berkeley, there was so much going on, I had trouble taking it all in. There were banners and signs everywhere. Rows and rows of tents, and a constant buzz of activity as protesters moved throughout the camp.
So I'm gonna need y'all to come a little bit closer.
But then I began to see a recurring theme I hadn't necessarily expected. The comparison to South Africa. Remember South Africa was written on posters. Students were handing out pamphlets explaining the country's history. I even met somebody who had a book of old newspaper cartoons. He showed me one, a kind of illustrated map to prove his point.
And the image here was published in 1988 in the Sacramento Bee newspaper. And it shows the map of, I guess, present-day Israel or Palestine. But instead of the country, it just says South Africa. Yeah. So I guess it's illustrating the common thread of apartheid.
And then somebody took the mic, and she directly linked the two movements on this campus plaza.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Andrea Pritchett, and I am an outside agitator. Now, once upon a time in the spring of 1985, in support of the people of South Africa who were being super exploited by the white minority, we encamped on the steps here in support of the demand for full divestment.
Andrea is now an eighth grade history teacher at Willard Middle School, just down the road. She graduated from UC Berkeley in 1985. And she began to explain to me how the protests had begun back then. She remembers that an encampment formed at Columbia.
And about a week later, we decided, well, what the hell, you know, we're going to bring our sleeping bags and we're going to start. And it's so eerie because right now, Columbia, yet again, was about a week ahead of us in this Palestine chapter. The historical symmetry is incredible.
In just a matter of days, camps were popping up at schools across the country. Andrea and a small group of other students started to camp out on Sproul Plaza, and the encampment grew fast. Until one night, about a week later, the police came.
In the name of the people of the state of California, I command you to immediately disperse and leave the campus.
158 people were arrested. And as I was going to jail that night, and I was sad because I had fallen in love with the sit-in. I had fallen in love with the profusion of energy and creativity and commitment and vision.
From jail, Andrea learned the protest wasn't over at all.
Far from being over. You know, there was this big rebound, and Mario Savio was addressing people.
Mario Savio, the grandfather of the Berkeley Free Speech Movement, was speaking in front of thousands.
If they can crush the Berkeley students, they can crush the others too. But they won't crush the Berkeley students.
You know, Alice Walker had spoken, Kurt Vonnegut. There was all these celebrities. All of a sudden, it was cool to be arrested. It was every day. It was relentless.
On the eighth day, protesters picketed the entrances to campus, urging students to join a boycott of classes. As more of the university community got behind the movement, the administration granted one of the demands, an open forum.
With pressure mounting, the governing body of the UC system, the Board of Regents, actually agreed to sit down for a public forum. It was held in the basketball stadium, and it was packed to capacity. The meeting was filmed, and you can see a number of the regents sitting in the front row as students speak one by one.
Whatever the true figure, American investment is undoubtedly crucial in running South Africa. And this is a state that is increasingly militarized, and American companies are helping.
I do not want to retire on the profits which have been earned from South African slavery, and I am not alone. We want divestment, we want full divestment, and we want it at the next Regents meeting.
The Regents did meet that summer in June 1985. And while they agreed to make a committee to study the issue, the measure for complete divestment failed.
9 yes, 14 no, 2 disqualifications and 1 abstention.
The Willie Brown divestment proposal has been voted down. Police are grabbing and pushing some of the protesters who have begun to chant and throw their facsimiles of South African passbooks in the air.
Police. And with that, the protests kind of just sputtered out. It was summer break and the encampment shut down. Fast forward to today, and we're at a similar point in time in the campus protests against the war in Gaza. It's summer break, the pro-Palestine encampment has disbanded, and Berkeley's chancellor released a letter saying the university would look into the process of divestment.
In that letter, Chancellor Crist wrote the UC system does not support war and, quote, we should examine whether UC Berkeley's investments continue to align with our values or should be modified in order to do so.
The letter talked about investigating companies in sectors like weapons manufacturing, mass incarceration, and surveillance, but did not come out in support of divestment from Israel. But in the end, and the letter mentions this, Berkeley's chancellor doesn't actually have the power to divest. That has to be done by the UC regents at the statewide level, and they've been very clear they have no plans to do so. The most recent regents meeting was also interrupted by protests.
A group of protesters stormed the UC Board of Regents meeting this afternoon after the board said student demands to stop investing UC funds in companies that support Israel would be too complex.
I hereby request that the appropriate police officer make a declaration of unlawful assembly and clear the room.
On top of all of this, divestment might not even be legal. In 2016, California was one of many states that tried to pass anti-divestment legislation. It's unclear how enforceable their law would be. But still, it seems unlikely the UC system is divesting anytime soon. But if the 80s have been any guide thus far, it's at least worth mentioning what happened next back then. And that brings us back to Andrea.
So yeah, that spring of 85, there was a divestment vote. We didn't win. And so we went into a tailspin over the summer. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? By the spring of 86, we came back with something called the Shanty Towns.
The Shanty Town protest was a two-pronged attack. On one side of campus,
we had Richie Havens He was a very famous kind of...
That was a guitar.
It was a guitar. It was an air guitar I'm playing to show you who Rashi Havens is. And he was playing at a rally, and meanwhile...
On the other side of campus, students were building an encampment so permanent that no one could take it down without a fight.
Have a carpenter on each one, boom, 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 boom. We slapped together these really sturdy shanties.
But the university was not going to let another encampment grow. They called in the police, and things quickly grew violent.
It's either leave or go to jail, make your choice now.
I'll go to jail, but I'd like to know what I'm being charged with.
Take him.
Andrea described how night after night, police would remove the shanties, and then each day, the protesters would build a new one.
Police struck out at people, and people were striking back at police, and people got their heads broken open.
After a few days, the students backed down from the shantytown protest.
The threat was that the National Guard would be called in, and that people were going to get really hurt. And that may have happened, but interestingly, the divestment issue itself had become so mainstream by that point.
By the summer of 86, many colleges had already divested. Even the Republican governor of California threw his support behind the movement.
And so we were on the edge of a governor's race, and Duke Majan, Georgia Duke Majan, was running against Tom Bradley. Duke Majan was no fool. He took the temperature, saw which way the wind was blowing, said, okay, let's divest.
The regents of the University of California agreed today to sell all their stock in firms doing business in South Africa. It's the largest divestment by any American institution so far.
In the end, the UC Board of Regents voted to divest $3.1 billion of the system's endowment with ties to South Africa. If you go to Sprout Plaza today, you won't see much of anything. The tables, the tents, the banners, it's all gone. Honestly, it can be easy to forget that generation after generation, this has been the site of so many different protests. Andrea has now camped out at 2.
As an alumni of UC Berkeley, it's incredible to me to see the resilience and the perseverance and the dedication of the students on these steps today. Yeah, you can give it up. So, from Berkeley to Soweto to Palestine, the people will be free. Power to the people, power to Palestine, power to the struggle, and power to the students. Right on.
And if her experience proves anything, it's that no political movement happens overnight. In Berkeley, I'm Eli Benton Cohen for Cross Currents.
Listen to the people, hear what they say.
Thanks, Eli. The archival footage used in this piece came from the documentary Soweto to Berkeley by Richard Bach, Eric O'Shaw, and Scott Wiseman. Also, special thanks to Ricky Vincent. You can find a link to the entire film and all our coverage of the student protests at klw.org.
What they call democracy. We will not share the blame of keeping people down with money in our name. Don't think that we don't care. Don't send our money over there.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Many of the recent student protests for Palestine have been held at university and college campuses, but some Bay Area middle and high school students have also organized demonstrations. At the end of October, students from San Francisco's Balboa High School walked out of classrooms.
This is the power I have at this school. The district gets funded for me being there. And if I'm not there for Palestine, I'm hoping it'll make a difference. I'm hoping that this will make a difference.
More recently, over 100 students walked out of Westlake Middle School in Oakland to protest what organizers call the suppressing of discussion about the Israel-Palestine conflict. These protests reinforce academic studies that show that people between the ages of 18 and 29 are the most politically engaged they've been for decades, and they're voting at historically high rates. Yet for all of that excitement and engagement, they still don't vote at the rates other segments of the population do. In this next story from TBH, our podcast by, about, and for teenagers, producer Annabelle Rubinowitz looks into the reasons for low voter turnout and how voting organizations are working to raise youth engagement.
In a little over 6 minutes, 17 of our friends were taken from us, 15 were injured, and everyone, absolutely everyone, in the Douglas community was forever altered.
This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean. Yet you all come to us young people for hope. How dare you? You have stolen my dreams.
As a high school activist, I spend my time advocating for issues like gun violence, reproductive rights, and sex education in schools. I seek to make political change on a national and local scale. Of course, I'm not alone in this. When I scroll through my Instagram, half my friends are hopping on the activist bandwagon by posting infographics on the hottest new political issues, like climate change. Then, they post selfies in my hometown of San Francisco, protesting against the Supreme Court's decision to limit reproductive rights. Their posts show them carrying rhinestone-studded posters with slogans. But whether I'm at a protest or in the classroom, I like to raise the easiest and most effective way to forge political change: voting. Where did all the passion go? The intense debates about forging political change, the rage that led teenagers to protest across city streets in masses, demanding reproductive rights and school safety policies. I know what you may be thinking, that Gen Z is actually turning out at record high rates in recent elections. For example, in California, the Census Bureau reports that just under 50% of Gen Z voted in the presidential election in 2020. But still, we're voting at lower rates than older populations. Millennials, Gen X, and seniors still turn out at higher rates. By the way, Gen Z refers to anyone born between 1997 and 2012. On a national scale in 2022, this most recent midterm election, young people's turnout rate was still terrible, in my opinion.
My name is Ruby Bell Booth, and I work at Circle. It's based at the Jonathan M. Tisch College of Civic Life at Tufts University, and I'm the elections coordinator there, which means I do a lot of our research around elections.
Circle is one of the leading national organizations researching youth voters. It's an acronym for the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement.
23% being a good turnout is definitely troublesome because over 75% of young people didn't vote. But the reality is that we are working from a place where as few as 12 or 13% turned out in 2014.
Here's a short clip from NBC with some Gen Z on why they didn't show up for the midterm election.
Are you going to vote this year?
Probably not, no.
The reason why I'm voting is because I clearly see our democracy is just falling to shambles.
When I don't know who to pick, who's the right person, I think it's better to choose no one than the wrong person.
We'll hear more about this later. But first, I want to explain why I'm concerned about these low turnout numbers. The right to vote was hard fought for, especially for those of us who have been historically marginalized. In the 1920s, young women across the United States protested in unison to pass the 19th Amendment and gain the right to vote. And in the 1960s, African Americans marched across Washington to win passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So why aren't teens today excited about participating in the ultimate form of activism when we have so much at stake? Are we just politically disengaged? Overwhelmed by the voting process? Lazy? The answer's not that simple. My 19-year-old sister Aurelie's first voting experience at her college, the University of Chicago, gives us a sense of why. When I asked her why she voted, she said she did it almost by accident, after a friend of hers persuaded her to do it.
Okay, sure, I'll register to vote. So I did, and then the man who registered me handed me a ballot and was like, okay, you go vote over there. And I said, what? I thought this was registering. And then he was like, if you're registering now, when do you expect to vote? It's gonna happen in the next week or so. Like, you might as well just do it now. So I was like, okay. And then I went and voted.
Aurelie cares about issues like drug addiction and homelessness, which she believes are related. She's engaged civically by providing relief to people who are addicted to drugs. But voting is not her top priority.
So my friend was like, we need to vote. You need to vote and be a responsible citizen. You should come with me and register to vote. All you need to do is register. It'll take 5 minutes.
You see, Illinois is one of those states that tries to make voting as convenient as possible. It's like other states that have a higher turnout, like California. Here in California, resident citizens with a driver's license are automatically registered to vote. My friend, Cole Alfonso, can confirm how easy it is. He's a student at UCLA who voted in the 2020 elections on campus.
So I mailed in one ballot, I think even for the referendum or 2022, and then the other one I went, UCLA has a couple voting centers on campus.
Pennsylvania is another state that experienced higher than average youth voter turnout rates. More than 31% voted in 2022, Circle's research shows. The state's voter registration makes voting easy and accessible for university students. My friend, Vishal Krishnaya, a student at University of Pennsylvania, shared his experience.
And so I just showed up, showed my ID, walked the booth. You know, the whole thing took maybe 5 minutes, less than 5 minutes.
Basic administrative details can have a huge impact, says Circle's Ruby Bell Booth.
Our research has found that policies like automatic voter registration, same-day registration, online voter registration, pre-registration, and vote by mail are all facilitative for helping young people to turn out to vote.
So, logistics are one of the big barriers for youth voters.
So those are things like young people not having enough time to vote, not knowing when the deadline to register was, having trouble filling out their registration forms, not having transportation to the polls.
The other huge barrier is a lack of confidence. Many of us feel overwhelmed, according to Circle's Bell Booth.
The other set of barriers I like to think about are really sort of cognitive almost and psychological or related to information. And so our research finds that over half of young people ages 18 to 29 don't feel like they're qualified to participate in politics. And that reflects a lack of self-confidence, self-efficacy, trust in the system, all of these sort of factors that can impact young people's desire to vote and whether they feel like they have a voice.
Other members of my generation don't vote because they don't feel like the parties are addressing their concerns.
Well, for me personally, sometimes I feel like reluctant to participate if I feel like the options aren't good enough or they're not as qualified. So I'd rather not participate than to participate.
That's Melissa Reed. She's an 18-year-old college student going into her second year at UCLA with a major in political science. Like so much of Gen Z, she says she's an independent.
I don't fully identify with either party. And so I'm really big on the ideologies of the candidates. And I feel like if they're not like fitting to my personal ideologies, then I'm more hesitant to participate.
Reed's sentiments match what pollsters have identified as a key attribute to Gen Z voters. They're motivated by the issues, not by the party or candidate, according to the Washington Post.
I would say as a young adult, definitely the age, I feel like the people in my age group are less represented when it comes to politics, even like wealth and equality and equity, all those things that it can really be summed up to representation, I feel like.
Tense nation still waiting tonight to learn who will be the next president of the United States.
While talking with my friends, I also discovered that most of them can't see how their vote in local elections connects to national issues that they care about, such as abortion and climate change. So, they'll vote in the polarized presidential elections, yet, when it comes to their local elections, they won't participate.
It's finally election day here in the United States, and Americans are heading to the polls to cast their ballots for the next U.S. president. Will it be Donald Trump or will it be Joe Biden?
Some young voters can't see how the laws on the ballot will impact their day-to-day life.
I feel like when you're younger, issues generally are more, you think of them in a more abstract way rather than as something that can directly affect you.
That's Vishal Krishnaya again. So, we've already discovered that one way to incentivize Gen Z is by making it convenient. But how do we reach someone in their late 20s who's never voted before? Or a teen straight out of high school who's skipping college? Or even a college student who has all the accessibility and practical means to vote, yet simply doesn't see the point in casting a ballot?
That was an excerpt from Annabelle Rubinowitz's story. You can find the full version and the rest of that season of TBH at kalw.org/TBH. Today's Cross Currents team includes Steffi Puerto, Cheryl Kaskowitz, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tentz, Shirin Adil, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Angela Johnston, Lisa Morehouse, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.